This is LifeMint.com and you're listening to the Mint Editors Podcast with me, Nandita Mathur, and Mint's editor, R. Sukumar. First, we look at the India-Japan story, which has been panning out this week because the Japanese Prime Minister is in Ahmedabad on a two-day visit. They've signed a number of pacts, agreements. They've announced, launched the bullet train. So what do you make of this
launched
partnership?
Launched the bullet train project.
Project, right.
Not launched
sorry.
The bullet train yet. It'll take some time.
5 years, yeah.
Japan has been bullish on India for some time. Mm. So if you look at many of the large Japanese companies in the infrastructure space, they've all built their presence in India over a period of time. They are clearly looking at a variety of areas, right? I mean, you have consumer products, you have including tech, and then you have infrastructure. And
right.
There are a lot of large Japanese companies which are interested in the infrastructure space in India. And I think makes sense, because I think for the Japanese, they're looking at viable and interesting business options.
Right.
There is a lot of infrastructure that needs to be built in India.
True.
The Japanese are, at geopolitical level, are a little uncomfortable about China for obvious reasons. India is also uncomfortable about China, again, for obvious reasons. So it's a natural partnership in some ways. And I think because of this, they are obvious and natural partners. And it doesn't seem to hurt that the Japanese Prime Minister and the Indian Prime Minister seem to share a good rapport, right? I mean, a bromance, as various newspapers have termed it.
Right.
But they do seem to get along. And I think it's good, because India needs, as we know, huge sums of money for infrastructure development.
True.
You spoke about the bullet train project, and I've read in some quarters criticism of this.
True.
Along two dimensions. One saying, do we really need it when there are
many
other things that this money can be spent for? And two saying, oh, we can't even seem to run normal trains. They keep derailing all the time. So do we need to do this? But I think this is a fairly backward looking argument.
The derailment one, yes.
No, both of them.
Yeah.
I mean, because let's be honest, you're looking at the future, right? And the bullet train in some ways is a piece of the future.
Right.
At one level. So investing in it can never be bad. Right? I mean, sure, you invest in it, but you also have to do a lot of other things. I would like to separate the two issues.
True.
The second thing is, we've spoken often about private sector investment in this country and how it's lacking.
Right.
And of how, at this point in time, we desperately need a growth driver. And the government is spending as much as it can, right? It's already spent a lot. And our analysts have looked at it. And last week, they had a piece that said it might have to come down because they're really, much of their gunpowder is extinguished. They've used much of it. But if you get a lot of money for a big project like this, there will be a cascade down effect that happens, right?
Right.
I mean, for steel, for cement, for construction,
jobs
there are
will
industrial
be created.
Corridors that are going to be built along it. So I think I wouldn't criticize it. Any infrastructure development is great. Of course, you can't pitch it along the planks of saying, oh, we will make it affordable between, because anywhere in the world, bullet train journeys are expensive.
Right.
But I think it's a good project. I think it's a futuristic project. It's always good to do things like that. We've also had reports of interest of one or the other of the Hyperloop companies in building Hyperloops.
Yeah.
We should do all of it.
Yes.
But at the same time, we should also make sure that our existing railway networks are safe, the people can travel affordably and safely and things like that. So I think, listen, I know everyone's been saying bullet train, bullet train, bullet train. It's a high-speed train, right? Some people call them bullet trains. It's a high-speed train. I think it's damn good.
Right.
I think it's one of those things that will could probably be the catalyst you need for a variety of other things.
Right. So we go to the Apple story, where Apple has announced its iPhone X. And it's a piece of sort of technological wizardry, with all the processor, which is artificially intelligent enabled, facial ID, it has wireless charging and so on. And of course, in India, it's priced at about $100,000, the higher end model, 256 GB.
That's right.
So do you think
people will buy it?
Will people buy it? Does it have the X factor?
Yeah, I think people will buy it. The initial reaction will be, I'm not going to pay $100,000 for a phone. But eventually, you will find that many people do go out and buy it. It's a combination of factors, really. Apple is pretty much a mainstream product in India.
True.
We carried a survey some time back. It was a cyber media research survey. We carried it in May. It's a fascinating survey. It surveyed the main markets in the country, which is Delhi, Maharashtra metro, for Mumbai, yeah. Karnataka for yeah. Bangalore, Tamil Nadu for Chennai, six markets or something. Gujarat, I think, was there for Ahmedabad. And it found out that the most popular smartphone priced over 20,000 was the iPhone 5. Right? I mean, the generation be damned. I think there's a certain cult associated with that, the certain image associated with that. Not too much of an image, because it's not as exclusive as it once was. But it is still very aspirational.
Yes.
So people like it. It's a damn good product. Not at the bleeding edge of technology, as various people in our newsroom who swear by Samsung products keep reminding me. But I don't think the users are particularly worried about that. And I think for a lot of older users like me, it's also the comfort, right? I mean, we don't want change. Right. We don't want to move to a different thing. It's so... this seems like a natural progression to move from one iPhone to another. And there are many people who progress through it from iteration one onwards.
Right.
People don't like change. Right? And I think the App Store and iTunes are also magnets that keep people sort of within the family.
True.
So there's no need to change. These are perfectly good phones, which are comparable to other good phones that other companies make. So I don't want to diss a Pixel or a Samsung 8 because the new iPhone has been launched. At one level, at the top end, you will find that there is pretty much parity between all these guys, all these brands. But it's just that the iPhone already has a stranglehold over that segment, the really premium end of the market. Except, interestingly enough, Nandita, and I think this is something that merits exploration, it's the premium end is no longer the premium end, right? I mean, in phones, especially for smartphones, it's expanded. And I think it's expanded for a variety of reasons. In the US and in certain other markets, like for instance in Singapore, you get plans. And when you get plans, you get the phone for pretty much free. Right? So it's very easy to... the price doesn't really matter. In markets like India, apart from, of course, people being able to afford it and all these other things, many of these people buy it through these interesting financing EMI schemes where you don't really have to apply for anything. Even if you buy it on Amazon, you pay $4,000 a month and you're done with it in a period of time. So then your cost of acquisition is not really that huge sum of money, right? Of course, if I ask our personal finance guys, they will do a net present value equation and tell you how much you're spending actually. But that's not how people who are spending look at it. They're looking at it in terms of their cash flows. So even young kids who are working in our newsroom, walking around with iPhone 7, that I can assure you some of them will be walking around with the iPhone X long before you and I buy the iPhone X. They're probably seeing it in terms of their cash flow. But as for this enduring appeal of this brand, I think at the end of the day, like you said, there is probably some X factor, right? I mean, which is true of all brands. It's not just this brand. At the end of the day, that's the difference between a product and a brand, right? I mean, there is that little intangible thing that draws people to a particular company's products.
Also the Apple event every year is sort of like a ritual. People look forward to it, and what they are going to
people looking forward
unveil.
To it is more of our class of people and some of the nerds and other things. But I don't think beyond journalists and beyond other things, I don't think the average Apple user particularly cares about this event. it's much more limited. But yes, they do make a big song and dance about it. And I think it's sort of become one of those annual things that people look forward to.
So many of these phones can actually be bought on sales, which leads me to the next story, which is the Flipkart Diwali sale, which they've announced a month actually prior to Diwali, September 20 to 24th. Amazon says that it's also going to start it, I think, 21st to 24th, and there's going to be a sort
I have no idea of the dates, but this is a trend that we've been seeing from last year, right? That many of these e-commerce companies have been announcing sales well in advance, which is all right. I think it helps people. It is an occasion to have sales. These sales sort of merge in my mind, right? I mean, there's no... because there's one after the other. It seems only yesterday that both these companies had an Independence Day sale. I'm sure they had one, right? So, and I think they've discovered that these sales, or as they call them, sale events, that's what they call them, seem to be contributing much more. I seem to be acting as a fillip for their sales and everything else. So, but it is true that a lot of people have moved their purchases online and a lot of people have timed their purchases to coincide with these sales. It doesn't matter if you miss one sale, the next one is never too far away.
And
so it helps everyone. I think it helps customers. It helps the resellers move inventory. And it helps the big e-commerce companies build share, which is all they seem to be interested in doing at this point in time. They're not particularly worried about profitability.
Right.
So I think it's brilliant for customers. It's brilliant for resellers, because in India, we only allow the platform approach in e-commerce. It's good for everyone.
Right. So the last story we look at is an economics one, where French economist Thomas Piketty has in a recent research paper sort of presented an exaggerated view of the inequality in India. And the Mint story and the Mint analysis suggests, you know, otherwise, that it's not so alarming as it appears to be, or as it has been made out to be.
No, I mean, that's not really what the Mint story says. What the Mint story says is, it is a serious issue, because India's Gini coefficient, which is a measure of inequality, is around 0.48.
Right.
The higher it is, it's bad. Right. So 0.48 is pretty bad. It's worse than in many other developing countries. I think it's lower than what it is in Brazil and China, but it is still pretty bad.
Yeah.
But what our article said, what our analysts said, was that some of the assumptions that Piketty made seem to be wrong, because they overestimate the income of the rich, or the people at the top end,
1%,
and they underestimate the income of the people at the bottom, right? So if you do that, you will naturally get an alarming figure, because what does Piketty show? It shows that the top percentile accounts for 22%, right? I mean, of income or wealth. And this figure was 6% in the 1980s, which was at the peak of Indian socialist achievement. Now, you can quibble about the numbers, but as our piece clearly says, the point he makes is a valid point, because all of us know it. We know it from data. We know it from anecdotal experience that these numbers have changed. So we have looked at other data and the work of other economists using data on national income from NSSO and various other places. And one of these, for instance, which was conducted some time back, and it looked at data till 2012, found that the top 1% actually account for 28% of wealth, up from 11% in 1991. But more interestingly, the bottom 40% account for less than 4% wealth, as compared to 5%. So the fact is, the gap is increasing.
Right.
There is a concentration of wealth that is happening, which happens everywhere. Because we've moved to a market-oriented economy, and there is a concentration of wealth that is happening. There obviously needs to be a broader distribution, right? With a better distribution that happens.
True.
Which will happen only when growth is more inclusive, when there are more jobs created, when there are better opportunities for people. As we've pointed out, better educational and job options, which again our analysts have pointed out in pieces that they've done over the last 6-7 months. And those are really the things that can help people move from one income category to the next, and then to the next, right? That upward march that happens. And I think that's the message that you need to take from it. So I don't think we should quibble about the numbers. Sure, right? These numbers may not be accurate, but the point he makes is a valid point. And I think that's the message we need to take from this.
What about the sliding economic growth which we've been seeing in the country, especially? I mean, the GDP is seeing a sharp decline.
This, right? I mean, I will basically repeat myself now from previous editions of the chats that
no,
we've
so
had.
My question is, what can the government actually do to sort of bring back the business environment?
We've spoken about this also, right? Because the macro looks good.
Right.
The micro doesn't look good. The macro has never been better in many ways. The micro has never been worse in many ways. And that's also because some of the growth drivers are gone. One of the growth drivers that we had was exports. Hasn't really been replaced by anything. We've spoken about this in the past. So we need an immediate growth driver. What could that growth driver be? Let's end this with a full circle. Maybe it could be more projects like the high-speed train project.
Right. So those were Sukumar's top stories for this week. Do let us know what you think. You can email us at feedback@livemint.com or follow us at Live Mint on Twitter and Mint on Facebook. The Editor's Podcast is also available on iTunes and audioboom.com. Please click on the subscribe button on iTunes to get weekly updates of latest episodes. Thank you for listening, and see you next Friday.